Hello and welcome back to another episode of the Cookie Jar Golf Podcast. Many of you will know we recently ran our inaugural spring meeting down at Prince's and Royal St. George's, and we had the opportunity to sit down with General Manager of Prince's Golf Club, Rob McGurk, to chat through his fascinating career as a professional golfer and how it came about that he's running Prince's Golf Club and the work that's been done there to improve it over the years. So we sat down with him, talked through those things, but also managed to talk through his eclectic 18, which is a fascinating journey of his life and his career and the places he's visited. It really was a great hour that we sat down with him to talk through. So I hope you enjoy it as much as we did. And without further ado, here's the pod.
Watch this.
So where are we sat anyway at the moment?
Lucas Lounge.
Named after?
Daddy Lucas.
That's good him. Story, isn't it?
It's a great story.
One of the great golfing stories, I think that. So just tell us a little bit about Laddie Lucas. Get us rolling.
Well, Laddie Lucas actually was born in room 24, which is above us.
No way.
He was. His father designed the original course with help of, which we only found out a couple of weeks ago, John Lowe. Designed Woking and was very much influential in the Haskell Ball, and Herbert Fowler, who again very well known designer.
Yeah,
funny enough, you'll find out today when we get to the ninth of the Shore Green that we're having a bit of trouble with it, because when they designed the greens back in the day, and I think he was quite influential in this, they built them with clay to retain the water.
I've heard this. They back used in, to do that, didn't they?
They did. So, and that green there, the clay bowl was a little bit too near to the surface of the green, and we're having trouble getting the water through.
Nice.
It was so well built that you couldn't, they did retain as much water. We've had to hollow-core that a few times to try and get the sand into it, holding a little bit too much moisture, so we're getting a little bit of disease. But yeah, so that's how they built the greens back in those days. To didn't have sprinklers, didn't have irrigation, so they built them with clay to retain the water. So Jasper Milner's, do you know Jasper?
Yeah.
He's been very helpful in digging old information out.
There's some passionate souls out there. The stuff with the Lucas thing's fascinating. I mean, we're obviously at the moment sat in the lodge at Prince's, one of the great buildings here. The Laddie Lucas stuff is just absolutely remarkable. I think when we came down for your first time, we sort of properly got to sort of hang out and spend some time, was the Christmas invitation, which we came down to. And yeah, I mean that whole stuff with Laddie Lucas. What was it? Did he play his golf here as a junior and everything growing up?
So he grew up here. Obviously, he lived in the clubhouse. Left-hander. There's a picture upstairs of him, 3 years old with his dad, with his little left-handed spoon. We play for the Laddie Lucas spoon every year. We've obviously had a couple of years off because of the pandemic. I mean, Justin Rose has played in it. Paul Casey's played in it. All the top names over the years have managed to come down and compete. And his original spoon is upstairs in the gallery, and that's the prize for winning the event. So it's 8 to 13-year-olds. He Walker Cup captain, MP, wrote a number of books. Amazing man, and obviously the story is during the war, he sustained damage to his Spitfire, and as he sort of coasted back towards England, he could see his home club, and he knew that the sort of the fourth and the eighth fairways were the flattest on the course, so he decided to try and land his Spitfire on those fairways, and he sort of landed it towards the start of the fourth fairway, ended up outside the boundary of the property, and obviously the famous golf writer at the time, Henry Longhurst, said, Lucas drives out of bounds again as his Spitfire landed outside the property. But what people don't understand is that once he got out of his Spitfire, he ran back to Manston, which is about 5 miles away, and went straight back up again.
Wow. It's incredible, isn't it? When you think they built them differently.
Completely different.
You wouldn't get a millennial behaving like that.
He captained Walker Cup, winged foot against Francis Weimer, who was the opposing captain. Obviously, we struggled a little bit over there. He was a great man, and the family are all. We still have them as members here. David Lucas is a really good player. Plays
is that right? Okay.
Played Hewitt for Stowe, and Alex is still a member. So, Yeah, still got the connections. She's great.
There's a great piece on the RAF Golfing Society's website, because I think I went down a bit of a rabbit hole for a few hours researching him. It was fascinating. How would you best introduce yourself?
Well, I guess sort of professional golfer come general manager of Prince's. Obviously my family bought the course in the early 70s. My father hadn't even started playing golf when he bought it. Met a guy in Sandwich in a pub, had been looking at industrial areas to purchase, and the guy just said, are you interested in golf? There's 220 acres for sale on the seafront. And he said, well, I'll look into it, and made an offer. Took a couple of years for the whole thing to go through, mind, because of the way that the family that had owned it prior to us, how the whole business was set up, the Bridgelands. And 1976, it all went through, and we started playing golf then, and we started to come down and get into it.
Was that your first sort of like start in the game then? When that was there, that was then like, right, okay, I'm going to start playing a lot now. I'm going to start, and then just naturally fell in love with the game.
When I was about four, I started playing down here.
Okay,
and we used to come down at weekends. We lived in Sevenoaks, and really, you sort of at that age, you're sort of playing at it rather than thinking about your future. When I sort of get sort of 10, 12, 13, 14, really started to get into it. And we're members at Knoll Park, which is a brilliant golf course. Mm-hmm. Great
Abercrombie,
fun.
Abercrombie, is that right?
It is, yeah. It's just an amazing bit of land. And
he's proud of that one.
He is proud. Yeah, you can see that. He's very happy with himself.
Can I just make sure that wasn't edited. That was sharp Abercrombie knowledge. Sorry, carry on.
But no, have you played it?
No.
It's brilliant. It's brilliant. And she used to play up there a lot and practice. I practice every day for hours. And there's two old pros up there. A guy called Sam King, ex-Ryder Cupper, hell of a character, smoked like 100 fags a day. Used to drive his beaten old Seat. He'd drive around behind us in his Seat around the course. Blue thing. And then he'd just watch you and watch you and watch you. He's a brilliant guy. He used to give us chipping lessons. He'd put match boxes out on the chipping green. And he'd say, right, don't worry where the ball goes. I just want you to land the ball on those match boxes.
Wow.
And that was to all of us. And he'd come out with all the young players and teachers. And then there's another guy, Peter Gill, who was a brilliant golfer. And the story is with Peter is that he used to go to tournaments and he'd go to the PGA Championship and have a chance of winning it. And he'd blow it down the last three or four holes because he didn't like making speeches. and there were two great characters when I was growing up that you would spend time with and you'd learn from.
Well, you need those people, don't you? Yeah. Investing, like, I think a lot of clubs, you know, you have a lot of these great sort of older figures, statesmen who have been fantastic players. And the really good ones really invest time in the juniors and doing that, because that just makes you a better golfer. When you've got someone with that experience and fast tracks you a little bit in terms of a bit of golfing IQ, teaching you how to play those shots. I'll be honest, I had no idea that you played tour golf until we did our Richard Bland podcast, and obviously we'd hung out at Cleve Hill, I think, before, and you just sent me a text going, really enjoyed the pod with Blandy, used to room with him on tour. I rang Tom, I was like, I did not know Rob McGirt played tour. So
we were all oblivious. You kept it quiet from us.
I did, yeah. So I played, I played Euro with MasterCard back then. So I'm actually, to go back even further, I played amateur golf till I was sort of 23, 24, relatively late, and I didn't get through to the home international teams, but I got to the first or second reserve, the home internationals. I represented England once in a three-man event out in France, and I had a blast playing amateur golf. Absolutely loved it. I grew up with Justin Rose, Lee Westwood, all those guys. Played British amateur at Turnberry with Sergio when it snowed. He shot 85. It was brutal. He didn't know what was going on. He shot 66 mixed day, mind. And but I got to the semis of the English, got to finish third or fourth in the Brabazon, but I just couldn't quite break into the main team. It was very strong. I mean, you had Garbutt, Pyman, the Yorkshire contingent then, Luke Donald, and we used to go away to Coventry and go to the training. It was brilliant. Back then, it wasn't quite as serious as it is now. I mean, we used to go out and turn up the next day, 9 o'clock,
breakfast.
Everyone like this. Everybody, it wasn't just us, it was Luke Donald, all of them were the same. David Howe. It was brilliant fun. And then I thought, well, I'm not going to break into this England team. It's very strong. So I turned pro. I mean, it took a little while to get going, as you'd expect. Won a MasterCard here, which then got me onto Challenge Tour, top five, used to qualify in those days. And ended up rooming with Blandy for a couple of years till he became really good and got his tour card.
Yeah.
And he left me with the others. And it's great to see him do well.
Is it strange for you, who obviously spent so much time with Richard over the years, clearly knowing that he's a talented bloke and he's gonna achieve something, but to not achieve it for so long and now see him, you know, really performing well, winning tournaments, he was leading the US Open, you know, did you know that was coming all along? Or
I think it's hard to tell, really. I knew he was very, very good. And maybe it's just a little bit of confidence and belief. I think with Rich, he's very single-minded, and he will keep going. I think that last year on Challenge Tour, when he lost his card and came back again, he said that he basically shut himself off.
Regained his card like five times.
Yeah, and he's got belief in his ability. And I think when I played with him when we were playing Challenge Tour, I could see that he was good enough to win, but the level was so high. And I fell off Challenge Tour back in 2004, then regained my card in 2005 through EuroPro. I think I won a couple of times, and stupidly decided to play football at the end of that year and snapped my patella.
No.
That put me out for a year. Came back to playing Challenge Tour 2007. And I sort of had a bit of an epiphany at the Austrian Open in 2008. It's the only tour event I made the cut at. Finished like 20 shots behind the leader, and I thought, these guys are too good. I need to go and get a proper job. So went through, did my PGA, got through all that, and it was great fun. And then started work here, really, just head pro, director of golf, and then work up to general manager.
How's your relationship changed, would you say, over time with particularly playing golf? Because we obviously know each other through stuff like Cookie Jar and having wonderful events down at Prince's like today, and you know, you're a huge fan, and we're here to talk about your Eclectic 18, which is principally course architecture, history, moments that matter to you in the game of golf. And for a lot of tour pros, it's a job, just playing. So has your relationship changed with the game, would you say?
I think when you're playing full-time as a professional or as an amateur, you don't appreciate the courses as much. I think that appreciation sort of come in the last sort of 10 years when I've actually started going away and playing some of these incredible golf courses. You don't tend to get to play the best courses as a pro.
Yeah.
When you're an amateur, you do.
Yeah.
You British amateurs and your British boys, your
great courses,
your English amateurs, you're always playing some, you think, oh, I can't wait to get there and play. But when you're in the thick of it, you're not looking at the architecture, you're just trying to shoot the best score you can.
Whereas the Austrian Open's not going to move you much, is it?
No. Do you know what the course was great, though? Fontana. Amazing golf course. I mean, it's like mind-blowing. 7,300 yards, greens 12 on a stint meter, and 20 shots off the lead.
Yeah, I think I'd still
hurts that. A little bit there. Jeff Milker's thing as well. It's like, amazing golfer, but you look at him on the range, you think you must be able to beat him, but you can't.
Would you say you're more into golf now than, you know, more passionate, more in love with the game possibly than you were back in those playing days?
I think very much so. There's less stress now. You go to a course and you look around and you enjoy it, and I think you can take a lot more in when you're head down, you've got a card in your hand, you're not really talking to your playing partners. Now I'm going out, I'm having great fun. Yeah. I mean, we've got a good little group here. James Bledge, obviously, Royal St. Paul's now gone to Royal Liverpool, set up this little nostalgic golf group during lockdown with Liam from St. George's and Rob Lee. And that really, it's only the last couple of years, but it really got me back into my old school golf with my Wooden Woods and my Ping Brilliums and my old bladed irons, which you've seen a little bit morning.
You've basically got a monopoly on all Ping LA standbacks.
I've been buying more, yes.
Max Fly Blades, Persimmons, some really nice stuff. Some quite nice niche sort of fluffy head covers as well in there.
Yeah, it was a bit out of sync, that was.
Bidding against on eBay for some of this stuff.
Have you always been a bit of an equipment junkie?
I love equipment.
There was a one iron in there that honestly, if I took it back in the backswing, I think you'd just see through it. It had zero loft. I don't know how anyone could hit that thing.
It's quite tough to hit. I've taken it on the range a few times, not on the course yet. It's difficult to hit. Now, I've been more into equipment than swing. Although over the years I've had great teachers, I've seen pretty much everybody over the time. We've had Mac O'Grady here for three of his golf schools, which were mind-blowing.
Oh, you spent time with him?
Yeah, we've all been to
What's
three
What's he like as a guy to spend time with?
He is incredibly intelligent. for me,
super intense.
Super intense. I mean, you spend maybe an hour on the range and 10 hours indoors and writing things down.
Really?
And he stands there and he goes through every single position of the swing. I mean, it was great. It was great fun. I mean, and you know, Ben Barham, who's a good friend of mine, we went to one, the first one we went to, and we did 10 hours in the Lucas, in the Lynx suite upstairs with the curtains closed. And he goes, right, we're going to go hit balls now. And we went to the range and we were hitting it like 30 yards. We were fatting it and topping it. And he just
completely gets inside your head.
In your head and we're going P1, P2, P. And he's standing there and he doesn't care where he hits. He's hitting balls towards the clubhouse. He's hitting balls towards cows in the field. He's just picking targets at a distance. He's going left-handed, right-handed. And their ball's going off like a bullet.
Really?
Incredible. And I'm not sure how old Mac is now, but his strength and his technique...
He's all kind of away from the limelight now, isn't he? He's very much kind of lives, I think, is it Canada now? He's over in...
I'm not sure where he is now.
Quite a private existence now.
I've not seen him for sort of 4 or 5, 6 years now.
A bit of an ethereal character, I think, now. It's like, sort of...
But incredible person to spend time with, the energy. And, I mean, the first year he was here, he ran to the range. He used to run everywhere. And you'll see our first tee on the Himalayas. He ran and he was messing around with my Labrador, Dexter, who's down the other end. And he was chasing him. He loves dogs. And the top of the ditch was green. And he just ran straight into the ditch in beige khakis up to here. And he came out and he just started laughing.
Absolutely.
And he just ran to the range. He's covered in black silt. And he just ran over there. And he was a hell of a character. And this guy with him called Matt Belsham, who taught me all the way pretty much when I was a pro. Brilliant guy who's of a driving range up in Hertfordshire. He still teaches Alex Norren. And I used to get Matt to decipher all the stuff that Mac used to say. I didn't understand it. It was incredible, sort of all your different positions of the swing. But a great, great guy. Can't speak highly enough of him, but he is a one-off.
But obviously Princes has been in your family for some 50 years now, or it's coming up to it. How do you think the course has changed in the last 50 years? How do you think as your relationship with golf has changed and you've got into more into the architecture and the love of it, are you getting more stuck in with what we can do with the course and improvements you can make?
Well, I think with the course, back in the day, when it was first built, it was probably one of the best courses in the world. It was very much very different then. You used to play very much like St. George's across over the ridge lines, then back across, and it would go everywhere. There's only 18 holes on the same patch of land, so we had loads of room. When the war came along, we were used for training. So the tanks bombed the greens.
Yeah, course was basically destroyed. Requisition taken over.
Exactly. So both us and Cinqports got hammered during the war. St. George's relatively unscathed. Mr. Bridgeland came in, he bought Princes, bought Royal Cinqports. He was not a fan of dog legs. He didn't like any hazards on the middle of the fairway. He liked long runway tees, so we became very linear.
Yeah.
So up and down the coast. And I think we perched it in the mid-70s. The course had gone back a little bit. Golf really wasn't our core business. So we sort of bumbled along through the 80s and 90s, and we got to the stage where we were starting to get close to getting planning permission for here. We used to own the Bell Hotel in Sandwich. We'd sold that once we got permission. And we looked at it, we thought we really need to do something to bring it back. So the first stage of it was 2008, 2009. We bought in EGD, Gary Johnson, looked at repositioning bunkers, which was great, but it was very much a small scale. I mean, digging out bunkers on Lynx courses isn't difficult, but strategically, as time moves on, people hit the ball further.
Yeah.
The bunkers weren't in play, so we looked at moving those around. Built the hotel, started to get busier, brought in Troon Golf.
Okay.
Just to help with basically marketing and how we managed the place, hotel, visitors, visitor experience. And they were great, sort of 3 or 4 years. But once you learn from them, you sort of like drop parts of their contract off, so you go
because they can manage the whole thing, can't they?
They can do. Right. We had a great manager in here.
Portfolio now.
Oh, they're huge, and they were great to work with. We had a really really good manager for 2 or 3 years who really helped us through it. A guy called Michael Lovett, who was at Valderrama, might know his son James, who does a lot of photography. Yeah. And he sort of got us through the process, and we sort of got through to the sort of 2015, 2016, 2017. We'd been up to Turnberry, seen what Martin Ebert had created there, and we thought, you know what, we could probably do that here. We did look at a number of architects, not just Martin, but due to his relationship with the RNA and the fact we host so many RNA events, it seemed silly to step away from him. And the brief was really, let's have a look at the Himalayas first, because that's tended to be the weaker nine. And you've got a blank canvas, but there's three or four things we would really like. We would like risk and reward, risk and reward holes. Yep. We don't want to continue to have 400 yards par fours. We would like to break up the linear aspect of the course, so we want some holes facing the sea. And we've got to look at the par threes, because they're all pretty much a similar length. So that was basically our input. Finished, we left it to the experts, and he's gone back with the Himalayas. We took out a hole, put in Bloody Point, our new par three,
yeah,
reduced the eighth Himalayas, which was a really long, boring 415 yard par four, to be a drivable par four. Yeah. Moved a lot of the tees up onto the dunes to create better angles. Yeah. So you've got left to right dog legs, right to left dog legs, but also you can see a lot of view of the sea. People, I think, like to hit down into a fairway then up over onto one. They like to see where they're going. And we did make mistakes. We've changed things. We've gone along a few of the holes. We've just rejigged because it hasn't quite worked. And that's a great thing about Martin. You can work with him. Mm. But yeah, it's been great.
Have you put in like a sneaky tee on nine as well?
We have. So we've put in the old Open Championship tee.
Which is the other side of the eighth green.
Yeah, it's an eighth green. We've opened up the old Himalaya bunkers.
Awesome.
And you look at it and you think back in those days, how they got the ball over that ridge line.
Yeah.
It's incredible,
with
really.
With the equipment and everything
with
like
the equipment
that.
They had.
Do you use that tee in competition?
We use it for the Hagen Trophy, which is when we play the three courses in one day.
Next week, isn't it?
Yeah, next Friday, yeah.
So we did a podcast just yesterday, actually, with Paul Craven.
Yeah.
He's obviously talking about the Hagen and everything like that. So
it's a brilliant event.
Yeah.
Oh, it's a cracker. So
it's a shame you can't go back to its original form and hop the fence.
So we did the first year, and we might have done it for 2 years. I remember Tarchetti, who used to be the pro here, trying to get over the fence in St. George's, slipped after a few too many whiskies and ripped his Galvin Greens on the barbed wire. But we did it the first year, but I think logistically it's difficult because you're coming into the middle of play and we end up in the middle of 40 Belgians at Cinqports 1 year.
Yeah.
And it didn't really work. But I guess we changed the time of year we play. It would always be the three.
Yeah.
Have we done it now? But it was a great story.
But you finished up changing the Himalayas up, and you've done that, and now have you started work on the Shore and Dunes? Or
so we nearly finished Shore Dunes now. So the Himalayas went down really, really well. You've got two very, very strong courses next to us: Royal St George's and Cinqports. I mean, St George's is one of my favourite courses in the world. As I mentioned, I think I played there last year more than I played here, which is not great. So we need to be different from them. Hence why we've gone back to the old bunker styling with Martin. Sand areas, we've got multiple sand areas across the whole site. When you go through a project like this and you're working with Natural England, with Kent Wildlife, if you want to put a new hole in, you need to give them something back.
Consultation, yeah.
So it's not quite simple. Go, why have you put sand scrape in there? Well, we want to put a tee in, they want a sand scrape. You want to have a new hole, we need a wetland.
Yeah.
All that goes hand in hand, and that's why we managed to get the whole project over the line, because we work really closely with English Nature. So we moved, the Himalayas went down really, really well. We thought, well, it now looks quite odd with the Shore Dunes sitting there, and you've got the Himalayas with these new tees and new paths. Everyone keeps saying how good your paths are.
Yeah.
So we moved the whole project up Shore Dunes, and it's been really successful, really pleased with it. It's not everyone's cup of tea, but 99% of people who play it love it.
Which is, of course, that we're having our event at today, which is all very exciting, the Shore Dunes, which is that they would be considered the 18. Is that the Championship 18?
It's the one that they use for all the tournaments.
Yeah.
And I think the Dunes is, the Himalayas is my favourite.
Yeah.
It has been since we bought Prince's, but the Dunes is possibly architecturally the strongest of the three. That's the one that all the...
Well, I guess it's a bit of a lead into your eclectic 18, which, by the way, is I think it's a masterpiece. This is a really good eclectic 18.
Thanks.
You know, there's a great list of courses on there that you've obviously played, and actually a couple I don't know about. I'm going to let you talk through what you've put together as a scorecard, and within there, just kind of, you know, pick up on any that are key. But given we're just talking about Prince's, no surprises, Prince's features in this scorecard. You've got 27 holes. How did you decide that it should come down to the 15th, which would put that as the 6th on the...
6th on the June.
6th on June.
I think when you start off trying to put together this Eclectic 18, it's really not that easy.
Well, we were talking about it at Christmas, weren't we, before?
Yeah, it's...
Because I was saying about this idea, and we're going to start doing podcasts with people about it, and you were like, oh, well, that's going to basically cost me a week of my life now.
It did, maybe more. My productive work went downhill for a good, I think I lost most of January. But it was great fun. And you're trying to look back not only on which holes are great, but on which holes you actually have got a meaning to you.
Great memories. Yeah,
memories.
Places that are special to you.
Like Brora. Ali and I are members there. Actually, the whole Fat Evie's a member there as well. And it's such a... We've had so much fun there over the years. That whole region, Brora, Golspie, Dornock, I mean, I could live there. I think it's magnificent. And it's just, when we get to that first tee at Brora, on top of the hill, looking at the sea and the mountains, it takes you away from work, takes you away from it. And we just...
Total escapism, and it is actually a world-class opening golf hole. The green site's amazing,
and a ton of options off the tee.
I always wang it straight at the green.
Oh, it's because you're a ball striker.
Rob has missed the fairway since 92. To be fair,
I went chicken stick, missed green.
It is a cracking opening hole, though. It is a really good opening hole, and I agree with you. I think that whole place around Brora is just—it's magical, isn't it? When you get there.
Chill.
First tee's right on down on the beach almost. You've just gone past that lovely little gate and down the stairs from the clubhouse, and the whole thing's just brilliant.
It's just so much fun. We love it up there, whether we're playing Dornock, Brora, Golspie, Skibo. It's just a brilliant place. Yeah. So that's why that area features quite heavily in my eclectic.
But it's a bit of a juxtaposition to hole two, isn't it? You've got Salt of the Earth Brora, one, and then Pine Valley two.
I think
there's a few big lux venues in here as well, Rob.
Two at Pine Valley is possibly the best golf I've ever played.
Really?
It's just amazing. Of course, we got very fortunate to meet a guy, Terry Caulfield, who's a doctor, who's a good friend of ours now, who's a member there. He's been a member there, will be 50 years soon, and he's very understated, really good guy. We go out every May, seven of us. We normally have a little Ryder Cup match. Get to play it five times in 3 days. Absolutely mentally breaks you. But the second hole, Pine Valley, is just an absolute belter. I mean, it's only 368, but it plays like driver 5-iron.
Because it's the one you drive and then it pitches up severely up the hill, doesn't it?
The whole bank is covered in like rough-style bunkers, and then the green is mental.
Because there's no bunkers at Pine Valley, are there? There's just insane amounts of waste... scrapes and they are bunkers, but they're not classed. There's no rakes in the bunkers, are there? Or anything?
No, there's no rakes. Bunkers are very firm, and the fairways are actually very generous.
But if you go off the tee, but room to play into, I hear.
It looks tight. If you hit it in the trees, I've never known a course where it's so difficult to get yourself back out into play.
Yeah.
And if you try a hero shot, I mean, you could take anything.
Yeah.
But that second hole is brilliant. Hit through a funnel of trees, coffin bunkers up the right and left side of the fairway. If you don't hit the fairway, you're just chipping out. And then you've got to be so exact for your second shot. You're trying to land a 5-iron or a 6-iron into a green that's almost like on a hog's back. And it's just a great, great golf hole. Every time you're actually down the tee, so excited, and you just... It's like excitement and trepidation. It's such a great golf hole. So, yeah, that's my number two.
There's another couple. I mean, just canter through a scorecard. There's a couple in here on the front nine, certainly, that I think, certainly a hole eight, for example, stands out to me as one where I don't know anything about hole eight.
That's all. Last breezes.
So what do we go? We go County down three, which is a fantastic,
fantastic
golf hole.
It's a great hole.
It's a really, hole eight. I mean, you can literally put 1 to 10 in County down.
So County down is a great golf course.
Because it's good. You can kind of use some courses like that to fill gaps. It's like, well, I'm not sure on... Because you have to kind of position them around with this exercise, don't you? Sort of thinking, well, I know I can probably lean on a few at County down.
Yeah, there's probably 16 at County down you could use. And even the other two are very good, so... It's one of those. So, and then Swindley Forest, fourth. It's a great par three up the hill. Royal Port Rush, again, one of those courses you could put a number of holes in. I just love that tee shot.
It's a great, great golf
hole. It's a really good hole. Again, with the right conditions, it's drivable. But if you miss the green, you could take anything.
I like to tell this story all the time. It was the fifth of Port Rush that Sam didn't speak to me for an hour before he drove to 40 yards short of the green.
You play into that infinity green, don't you?
Oh, you don't want to blade this into the sea.
I get a little trapped with a wedge sometimes. And I just ran out of road with this little approach shot. He said, you really don't want to thin this. And obviously, I've half balled this thing. I think it was still going up over the bay.
So. Straight in the forehead. Yeah, over the green.
I'm a bit disappointed there, Tom. But
I like to mention that whenever we have a chance to talk about it. So.
Six, Royal St. George's, what a par three.
The Maiden is just a brilliant hole. Amazing green. People, I don't think the green gets enough credit. I mean, it seems almost three tiers, and it's just brilliant.
And I played it for the first time yesterday, and on the tee, if you've never seen that course before, which I hadn't, it looks like you're hitting onto a telephone box. There's like no space. You're like, this is the smallest green I've ever seen in my life. But it's actually just beautifully bunkered, and it's a complete optical illusion because it's a perfectly playable green with that sort of diagonal left to right shape that goes front to back, and it's fabulous optical illusion from the tee.
It's just a great par three, and in the winter when you play the course, I tend to play there quite a bit. They put the pin front left, which is such a great hole. It's only a 9-iron or a wedge, but if you get it spinning right to left and you miss it left, you could take 8.
Yeah, you're right down that. It's just a great hole.
And again, with the wind, with St. George's, you never know. It plays in so many different directions that you're always at some point fighting a different wind. You can never get comfortable. And I think that hole's one of those worldies where you could hit a wedge, you could hit a 3-iron. It's just a great hole. So, and then obviously Sunningdale Old, number 7. It's just one of those courses you could put numbers holes in. It's just a great hole. Tough tee shot over the bank, and then quite a small green actually to hit mid-iron into. And then Les Breeses. So
I've never heard of this. Yeah, this is the standard.
Yeah, so Les Breeses, I used to go and play a pro am there every year with some guys who are members at. Trying to think of the course.
Where is it?
It's down in Malaga. So I used to play with good friends who are members at La Zagaleta, which is. They did a program on it a few years ago, Piers Morgan, where they got all these Russian oligarchs living up there. We used to go and play in this program at Les Breeses. And I think it was the 1973 World Cup they played there. Jack Nicklaus and Johnny Miller won it.
No way.
And Johnny Miller said the eighth at Les Breeses is basically one of the best golf holes in the world. So I was reading up before. I asked what he's on about there. It was the eighth, I think 11th par three. Well, this hole, you saw it, you hit. Slight dogleg left to right, but a big barranca down the right, almost like a hog's back fairway. And the further right you go, the shorter the line is. So you've almost challenged off the tee to hug the right-hand side. And then the second shot is to like a kidney-shaped green, pretty similar to St. George's, but almost going the other way, with a river in front of it, or like a ditch in front of it, but just framed by bunkers and palm trees. It's just an amazing hole. It's absolutely stunning.
Am I assuming you birdied it every time you played it? Are you one of those?
I can't remember actually birdie. I just one of those where you sort of get you just looking at the hole when you walk in and think, how amazing is this? And you stand on the green and you look back down the hole. You're trying to take it all in. It's just an amazing golf hole. And Carl Phillips went back there about 5-6 years ago and did some redesign. So he did a really good job with it, but that hole wasn't touched.
Really? What do you think makes for a great golf course or a great golf hole? Like, what are the sort of attributes? I find a lot of people answer this very differently.
I think it's something, if you've got, I want to be challenged, but I want the hole to, I want to have a chance to make birdie. Mm. I don't particularly want to be in driver 3-iron. I want like tight pins on ledges, try and take on a bunker, take on a hazard, and then give you the chance to make birdie. I think for me, that's more of an enjoyment,
almost like a score variance. They're giving you something to go after, but
very much so. Yeah,
that feeling that actually there's a you can make birdie, you can walk off this with a six as well.
Very much. When I play around here, I play off the yellow tees. Don't go all the way back because I like to make birdies.
Yeah,
and you can the further forward you go here, the tighter the tee shots become. So I think it's I like the half par kid. We talk about his
God, he gets too many mentions on this podcast. I'm not. I'll have to edit that out.
I give him a bit of stick a couple of weeks ago, but he's okay. He's back in the good books. But I do like that idea. If there's a 4.5 whether it's a 2.5 or a 3.5. I think it's brilliant.
But a lot of these are kind of within that mould, aren't they?
They are. There's a few films.
Interestingly, and this is completely off topic, but I was chatting with the owner of the Addington, right, I know it the other day, and he was saying, I'd never given this any thought. He said, if you didn't play Stableford, you would never write a par down on a scorecard. The only reason you need a par is for Stableford, because in medal, I did it in 78 strokes or whatever.
Yeah.
But I'd never thought about it like that.
It's literally a symptom of Stableford, the reason you need to use it.
I thought that was quite interesting.
Well, I think, is it Swindley, for a long time, they didn't really look at par or handicaps or anything. You just went and played.
I think it is a lot more, you know, we've obviously having our spring meeting today and tomorrow at Prince's and Royal St George's. And by the way, be remiss not to say a huge thank you for making that possible for us here. But we're talking to Callum about the course setup, and he said, we can stretch this out, we can get this sort of over 7,000 yards. I said, don't worry, just like put some of the tees up. I said, if we come in after day one and a few people have shot 61, we'll worry about it then.
Yeah.
But I don't think it's going to happen. So
No.
Does a little bit of your sort of maybe past tour life of, professional golfers want a golf course to be fair. They want to see what's in front of them, famously. Almost many of the attributes that maybe, your amateur golfer doesn't look for so much. They quite like quirk and in surprise and, the element of luck out there. Is it hard to shake some of that stuff maybe with fairness? And
I think so. I mean, I never really went to a golf club course and thought it was unfair. I always thought if you hit good shots, you're gonna score well. I'm not a big fan of just keep bashing my head against a door hitting driver 3 with driver 2 iron. I like to hit short irons, mid irons. When I grew up, I loved chipping and pitching, sort of 80 yards and in. So
get so good as a junior, don't you?
Yeah, I know. You sort of, you see how much backspin you can get, don't you? So it's
I've never seen backspin, so it doesn't bother me.
Spell it these
but,
days.
Yeah, so I wanted to play the short courses, and when I tended to do well, although I hit the ball far enough, I tend to do well on the courses where I was hitting a lot of mid irons and low irons rather than just continue hitting 3 irons, 2 irons.
I think there's far too many golfers that will are obsessed with, like, certainly, in this area of the world, you've got Royal St George's next door that's had the Open. I want to go to the Open, and they say, let's go off the Open tees because I want to know. But like, when you're just nuking drive 3 wood all day, every day, I mean, Royal St George's actually isn't monstrously long, like say they can stretch out Hoylake or something like that. But it's not enjoyable. I've never enjoyed it. Just like nuking 3 wood and like the best I can make is a bogey just so I can say, oh yeah, I shot 25 shots worse than Colin Morikawa.
I think it's really hard not to enjoy golf courses that are around 5,000 yards for some reason. And yet you can play a lot of forgettable golf courses at 6,500 yards.
Yeah, I agree.
The number of times people walk past that, just those little nuggets, it's really hard not to enjoy going and playing Formby Ladies. Because, there's no better feeling than just keep clicking irons at the pins and trying to shape shots and stuff. So tell us a little bit about your back nine and obviously the ninth as well. So we're just looking at it. So Goldsby,
which I believe the locals call McCypress Point, is...
called what?
McCypress Point.
Yes, well, I think James Bunch, I don't know James, he's a great, great guy.
Is that
guy.
Because of some of the way the trees interact
very much
with the landscape
and everything? We turned, Ali and I played there in January.
McCypress Point.
Played in January for the first time. We thought it cost us, because we're members at Brewer, it cost us £10 each. And we thought, but it's just... And
Gosby is the one where you play a few through the trees.
You start off with a par 5, then a little par 3. Then you play like 5 holes along the sea, and they're just... brilliant. I mean, absolutely brilliant. Then you go inland, and then it becomes like Cypress Point. It becomes all heathland, and the ninth hole is just a brilliant hole, and you've it's like 400 odd yards. You hit a big hog's back fairway, throws the ball off right and left. Second shot, you hit sort of semi-blind to a little punch bowl green that runs off at the back of the green. It's just magical against the backdrop of the pines. And we played it, and there was no wind. It was January. We didn't even have woolly hats on. I thought, it's so quiet. I thought, this is what golf means to us.
People would be served well when they're up there to just find extra time to go and play Tain and Goldsby.
Yeah.
Brewer, I think, is really on the map up there now through...
No lane-up guys.
And obviously, they're just Fortros. Yeah, but you get the sense that even so, people will play Dornoch, Castle Stewart, Brora, you know, you run out of days. You need almost a week to really get through the Highlands.
It's a great spot.
It's a staggeringly good golfing area. There's a lot of energy on East Lothian and Fife, but I think the breadth and diversity of the golf courses in the Highlands is pretty much unmatched for Scotland, really.
It is, and it's the last place pretty much now where you, not value for money, but you can go there and you think, do you know what, anyone can afford to play there. Even Dornoch, you can get there in the winter.
Yeah.
We played there in January.
It's Highlands deal in spring. Silly.
It's such a special place, yeah. So, yeah.
And then you've gone from being the accessible to the inaccessible.
We go
again.
Brioux, but Lux, to be fair, on the back nine. I don't know if maybe you just want...
It's just flex, just a complete flex
This is a really luxurious back nine.
Yeah, so Valderrama 10, I know that you got a little bit of stick in your...
I think it's a great golf hole. Yeah, I stand by it.
We played in the Callaway Cup there. Used to take 10 pros from the south and play against 10 pros from the north. And so we go and play them at Valderrama. And but Callaway paid for everything. It was great. And
shout out to Callaway.
Yeah, there we go. Sorry about that.
But this, no abs in this pod, please.
This 10th hole, I just think it's magnificent. I mean, that you tee off right, pretty much outside the clubhouse, elevated tee, down
just
to
out
a
of vodka
fairway.
Or something.
Yeah, exactly. Well, we've more than that. Gin and tonics for us. And then fairway swings downhill left to right. But what I remember more than anything is how exacting the second shot was. Because if you put too much spin on the ball would come 50, 60, 70, 80 yards back down towards the water.
It gets down, it literally in the water.
But if you hit it over the back of the green, you could then chip it in the water. It was just a brilliant golf hole. And with Valderrama, it's quite windy there. And trying to pick the club, greens are relatively small.
I mean, I know you said, I've never played an unfair golf course. I'd say Valderrama is when you're in the thick of it, feel desperately unfair. It's so much fun. Because it's almost on steroids how good the condition is, isn't it? You know, there's just not a blemish out there. It's very pure, but it is wickedly difficult.
It is difficult when it gets windy.
If you take it personally out there, you're not going to have fun because it's, you know, the course is going to get you. Like, it's going to kill you. The pros hate it.
It does get to them. It's great.
But it's such a great place. And I think that 10th hole, I agree with you.
It's a great, and there's a lot of great 10th holes. I mean, 10th of St. George is brilliant.
Yeah.
And
we found that. There's a lot of certain hole numbers that are just really...
A lot of really good fourths. I mean, the fourth... Yeah. You can go around... Fourth at Deal is one of the best par threes in the world. But I just couldn't get it in.
I'd like to talk to you about 11.
Yep.
Because I'd say you've gone with Sawgrass. And if you said to pretty much anyone who's ever... watched the players, that it would be a hole that no one would pick out, I imagine.
No, we played a pro-am there about 5-6 years ago where we played dreadful. But the only thing we did do, we won best in bar, so we got a prize for that. But that's all we did get.
More alcohol.
And it probably reflected in our play. It's just a brilliant par five. You hit sort of away from the hole to start with. It's quite a generous fairway. Then you have the sand area and the brook that goes around the green. The green's tiny, and you're almost hitting into the narrowest part of it because you're hitting across it. I just remember hitting an unbelievably good second shot with a hybrid, pitching about a yard on the green, going over the back of the green, up the back, down side of the bunker, and going, oh my God, I couldn't have hit it. And how do these pros hit irons in there and stop it on the green?
It was the 11th that John Rahm lost his head, wasn't it?
Yeah. That was where the caddy, he started trying to hit that hook 5 iron off a hanging lie.
Because his caddy said he shouldn't
hit it.
With the water.
Yeah. And his caddy was like, I really think this is a play, John. He was really in contention. I want to say this was 2019, now maybe 2020. And I think the caddy nearly ended up wearing the 5 iron afterwards.
But Sawgrass is one of those courses where you go there, you've seen it on TV, and it's one you just want to play. You don't realise how good a golf course is you actually play on it. And every hole, again, you're looking back down the hole going, how good is that hole? I mean, it's hard. But if you play well, you'll score well. And
that whole Pete Dye stuff is, you know, it's a lot more sort of maximalist, isn't it? I suppose you could say, than, you know, your British links. It's really in your face stuff with, you know, how he, you know, gives you the options and the way that the course is set up. I can imagine it's a great experience,
and you get around sort of 16, 17, 18.
The only question we want to know, did you hit the green on 17?
17 was okay. I hit that with three rounds there. We played the day after the players.
Oh, did you?
So it was in great, all the stands are up, and it was when Ricky Fowler won. And it's a big green, actually. You'd be amazed.
I still don't back myself though, Rob.
No, it's a big, big green, but you stand there, you're nervous.
Yeah, of course.
Even
yeah.
in a practice round, you'd go, oh my God, don't miss it. But it's like just hit in the middle of the green, just walk off.
Yeah.
Great hole.
Moving on, there's a couple in here. There's something to talk about.
We've got St George's Hill 12, Merion 13, Dornoch 14, Shaw and Dunes we talked about, yep. 15, Bayonne 16, NGLA 17, and Old Course 18. Within those, what are the kind of standout, you know, what are the, any there with special moments, any kind of big influences on you?
I think obviously Merion short par 3, great hole. I mean, almost like a blind hole. I mean, if you when you get to play it, you tee off and the bank in front of the green is quite big, and you can see the top of the flag. It's just a great hole, and it's right next to the clubhouse, and it's easy to take five as it is to take three, even though you're hitting a wedge in. Yeah. Raw Dornoch Foxy, you can't really leave that hole out.
Incredible golf
hole,
isn't it?
It's just a brilliant hole with no bunkers, incredible green. One of my favourite courses. And it took a while to like Dornoch. The first time I played, I didn't really get it.
I'm the same. Yeah, everyone thinks I've got two heads.
No, didn't get it.
But going back, you know, you see more of it. But the first time I was like, yeah.
Yeah, and I'm breaking the world, thinking, not sure about this. And all of us said exactly the same thing. And then I played it again. I thought, this is quite good. And then played it three times, four times. I think, oh my God, this place is really special. Yeah. It's one of those, it's a grower.
It's a massive grower. I think there's a lot to be said for courses like that. You can play a lot that really hit you hard on a one time, but you go back and it doesn't give anything extra on
and
the second time.
And when you go there, when the gorse is out as well, it's just a completely different experience.
Beautiful, yeah.
It's just like that sea of yellow.
It's also the bunkering. It's the best bunkered course I think I've ever played, not only for strategically but the presentation. I mean, to see the revetting that sharp,
they are incredibly well put together,
really, really good. And it's a great course. And then obviously Prince's Shore Dunes, my sixth and a Dunes there, really good par five, dogleg left to right, great tee shot down into the valley. Then you've got the green that's sat on the ridge line. If you miss it left, you can take anything. You miss it right, you take even more. So the green's 50 yards long. Brilliant hole. And Bayonne, we're fortunate enough to play there with the owner, Eric Bergsoll.
It's East Coast.
It's in New York. It's basically Ron Hudson. And Eric bought the land. He'd owned a number of golf courses beforehand. And I believe it cost him pretty much $1 million per hole to build. But he apparently won the contract to dredge the Hudson. Said to the local authority, if I clean this old Swedish oil refinery, if I build a golf course, and it said, well, you have to clean up from an environmental point of view. He just built this course, and he loved the Scottish and Irish lynxes. And the 16th hole, you hit back towards Manhattan, elevated tee, big wide open fairways. But it's quite a long hole, about 450, I think, from memory, to a green that's got like three or four tiers on it. And it's just a brilliant hole. And so we had a day there with him. We had lunch with him. Then he rented his boat, took us into Manhattan. Spent a day
life's
in Manhattan.
Tough,
I know,
life's
it's amazing.
Tough,
these are serious then days.
Then he brought us back. We all had dinner in the clubhouse with him, and then we went off to Pine Valley. So it wasn't too bad. But it just always remember days like that, and remember holes like that, and how we were treated, and how we were looked after. And it's a great course. Very lucky to have played it.
I'm glad you jumped in first, though, Rob. Because I'd have been like, oh, I've never. What's that French golf course like? So I'm glad you jumped
in. National, you've got 17.
It's brilliant par four down the hill, shortish, hitting back towards the sea. It's one of my favourite golf courses in the world. I mean, again, maybe the best green complexes of anywhere I've ever played.
The template stuff stand out if you didn't know it? Would you notice? Because obviously I think the whole thing's modelled on the series of the greatest template golf holes and things like Eden Greens and Redan.
Yeah, I don't think so. I mean,
you wouldn't notice it necessarily
not
if you played it. It's quite subtle.
I think you're just trying to take in the course and the experience. And the fairways at National, they're wide. But it's when you get, the nearer you get to the greens, it becomes more and more difficult. And the greens are brilliant. And what I like about them, pretty similar to here, not overly heavily bunkered. I mean, we have hardly any greenside bunkers here. I like to be able to play loads of shots around the greens, chip and runs, lobs.
Loads of short grass.
Like hacking out of rough. And NGLA is like that. You can play a lot of shots around the greens.
Lots of shot options, which I think is a good thing.
Which is brilliant, yeah.
I was going to talk about hole 18, but if you forgot something on
the NGLA.
Well,
no, obviously the 18th of the old is almost sort of, in some respects, you know, speaks for itself. I looked at the scorecard. We've talked about a few here. We've teased you a little bit. We had James Day on obviously doing this exercise, and he, you know, cited a load of Lux places. I want to know, off the course, Pine Valley, Las Brisas, Valderrama, Merion, Bayonne, NGLA, best off the course experience out of those?
Pine Valley.
Really?
Yeah, Pine Valley. So Mr. Cofford, who we go with, once a year they can bring seven guests, so you can have two fourballs. We have this weekend in May. Another guy, Andrew Wood, who you might know, he's marketing man. He's a bit out there, but he's good fun. He sort of introduced us to Terry sort of 8-9 years ago, and we stay in the clubhouse. There's eight or ten rooms there. They have a lot of accommodation around the site. Jacket and ties for dinner. I mean, the last time we were there, we were up singing.
Is it a seafood chowder or something like that?
Oh, it's the
turtle snapper or
two. Yeah, turtle snapper, which actually, I'm not sure if it's real turtles or not, but it tastes great. And they put a little bit of brandy in with it. And we have dinner every night, jacket and ties. One year we had all the Americans up singing Bye Bye Miss American Pie and jacket and ties, all these old boys up.
Yeah.
Be Augusta members, they could be.
Can enjoy it there. It's not a place where you feel on edge.
Absolutely
sometimes places
not.
Like that,
no.
You can really feel
it's
like...
It's really good. You have to respect for rules. No mobile phones in the clubhouse. You can take pictures, you go around the course, take pictures in your room, but you just can't answer phone calls.
Yeah.
Got one of the smallest pro shops in the world. It must be the most profitable for
per square foot.
Great practices.
Cars of soap and stuff like that.
Cost per item per square foot would be...
Yeah, it's not too bad, actually, for expense-wise, compared to some of the American courses.
Volume of purchase.
But also, it's got the most amazing par 3 course, which is modelled on a lot of the approach shots.
Really?
To the holes in the course. I believe that when they built it, they went out with a compass and they actually built it in the same direction as half a fourth, half a fifth, half a... It's absolutely brilliant.
Yeah.
You can go around there with gin and tonics in buggies. Have a blast, but no, that's the most amazing golf experience I've ever had in my life.
And the whole stuff as well there, you know, I'd love to just, you know, even just to hang out in the clubhouse and see some of the Crump stuff there. And obviously, you know, the story around him completing the course and what happened to him, you know, the whole thing's just, you know, it's one of those kind of, you know, it's one of golf's special places, isn't it? Rob, well, I'm very mindful that we've kept you for a long time. We've got a big couple of days ahead. I'm literally trembling with excitement.
Rob's only agreed to podcast with us so we don't start boozing at 11 a.m.
I think it's a really savvy move. It's kept us off the source. I think fantastic spending time down at Prince's. This is a really special place. Seeing everything on the walls, seeing everything from the history to Morikawa last year staying here and winning the Open Championship. You know, big thank you for sort of supporting us with the spring meeting, but also, you know, well done with everything that's happening here. This is a fantastic place that's just going from strength to strength, though.
Thanks, chaps, and good luck with everything. Happy to support you, and looking forward to the years ahead.
Cheers, Rob.
Thanks.
Cheers, Rob.
Watch this.